At school, my friend James Smith told me about a band he had discovered, one that was unlike any of the other bands we were listening to in 1987. It was something that he called cut-up, and I didn't understand what that meant, but he assured me it had to be heard to be believed. And over at my father's house that evening, James played for me an album called A Big 10-8 Place, and it was by a band called Negative Land. And he was right. I'd never, ever heard anything like it before. It was sound collage to the nth degree. It was bizarre, strange samples, along with some sort of unworldly view of something called Contra Costa County, with sound effects and stereo imagery that I just did not expect to come out of speakers. I'd never experienced anything like it. It's a phrase people use all the time, but I assure you, it was mind-blowing to a young junior high school student. And I think the only thing that would have been more mind-blowing at that time would have been if I had explained to myself that 20 years later, I'd be putting the band up in my house. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and keeping myself out of debt. Thanks to William Hearn, Backtracks FM, Daniel Boyd, Jeff Atwood, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been helping me stay out of debt. The entire band that calls itself Negative Land is a really interesting story in itself, and it's worthy of much more expansive history than I'm going to give here. I'm only going to focus on one specific member, Donald Joyce. Born in New Hampshire and relocating to California, Don was a character, and by the time the band Negative Land forms in 1980, Don's already established and older than anyone else that will ever join that band. He was established working in radio. I've already described my experience working within a radio station in the late 80s when I was at college, and those 8-track-like tape machines, the ones where you would press a button and it would go on for anywhere between 30 seconds and 3 minutes, that technology drove a show that Don put together in the early 1980s that was called Over the Edge. Outside of the work with this band, Negative Land, Don kept a radio show going weekly at this station, KPFA, in California. It was a sound and audio collage show that enabled hours and hours of somnambulistic or shocking or strange soundscapes to come out over the radio. I mean, we're very used to the idea now of radio essentially being a jukebox, and it was a jukebox since at least the 50s and 60s. With the advent of recording technology, radio stopped being another way of doing live performances on the air and started to become more of a pre-recorded experience where a record or tape would be ready to go, and then a DJ, who was not much more than an operator, would instigate different recordings one after another until the day or the shift was over. Of course, if that's all your job is, it wouldn't be much time before that could all be automated. Don spans these kinds of experiences. He's aware of how things used to be. He can see where things are going. And he bucks the trend by creating the show that goes on for hours and is essentially freeform. Radio, with its controlling commercial aspects, doesn't like freeform, doesn't like having dead air or having moments at which you don't know what's going on. The Over the Edge show was part vaudeville, part radio theater, and even more importantly, social commentary. It was a way for him to put together theme shows, shows in which there were recordings from one era or one way of thinking, and he could combine them on the air live. He had building blocks to build whatever world he wanted to, and over time, he went from merely very good at it to masterful to the point that he could have a show where he was talking to people over the air or playing something while moving around a bunch of tapes with his hands and getting them ready and cued and about to tell a story. Negative Land was a collective of like-minded people who loved sound collage and putting things together and having sound commentary and being otherworldly. Don fell right in with them, and his influence is everywhere. He combines all sorts of sounds on their records to the point that you have tapes from one era arguing with recordings from another. You have videotape sound going next to 1930s movies or film noir arguing with John Lennon. It's everything and nothing, and I love it. Don Joyce's work on Over the Edge and Negative Land wasn't designed to have everyone get a foothold, and there were people who could listen to it for about 5 or 10 seconds, realize there was nothing in here for them, and they would move on. Similarly, there were people like myself who, 5 or 10 seconds in, said, "I have found my home." Negative Land produced a number of albums, including A Big Ten 8 Place, Escape from Noise, Points, Helter Stupid, each one of them very unique and giving a different deep message to them. Probably their most infamous one is U2, where they cut up samples of the band U2, the Considerations of the U2 Spy Plane, and outtake recordings of Casey Kasem cursing. And that album got them sued by Island Records. It lost them their record company and caused them to go back to their own record company, Sealand Records, and put them right at the intersection of copyright, performance, fair use, and corporate stranglehold of the creative spirit. It was, in other words, truly groundbreaking. Negative Land did perform live, but it was always in California, and I couldn't imagine what those shows were like. Until in the early 1990s, I was walking through my college radio station and saw that there was a poster for various performances at this nearby Jamaican club, and one of them said it was Negative Land. Now, this was impossible to me. How would that happen? But it had turned out that when this band had decided to go on an East Coast tour, they had booked with an agent who put them in whatever place would take them, including the Western Front, a Jamaican club that hosted all sorts of weird bands. I traveled there really early and discovered that the band was setting up. I even sat in while they were working on their sound check and had the pleasure of being the sole audience member for a performance of one of their songs. If I wasn't a super fan before, I was then. If it had all just kind of stopped there, I think it would have been entirely fine. I loved the albums that they were making. I loved the performances when I got to see them. And I just simply would have been a really big Negative Land fan. But luckily, it didn't stop there. I'd had conversations with Mark Hosler a couple times about the material that Negative Land had. They had a problem, you see. Over the Edge was producing hours upon hours of footage every week, and there was no place to put it. There was so much more to have, and wouldn't it be great to put the real audio files somewhere, to put them where people could listen to entire shows? And Mark found out that I was working for a hosting company and asked me if we had the space for it. And to be frank, I just didn't think we did. But I told him I would do what I could if he thought it was something that they could put together. Hosting, it's not surprising, can get very expensive when you start to talk about putting hours upon hours upon hours of audio up, especially in the late 1990s. So, unfortunately, that discussion didn't go anywhere. But after the debacle of the U2 lawsuit, Mark Hosler had an interesting second career as a lecturer talking about that case and what it meant, and he came back to the Northeast on a regular basis to give lectures about Negative Land. And so I had an opportunity to see him in person multiple times, to meet people he knew, and including the first time I met a teacher who was a Negative Land fan named Kevin Driscoll, who went on to do incredible work in BBS history and is a continued friend to this day. We met in the lobby of the Coolidge Corner Theater while Mark was giving a lecture. So at one point, while he was doing these lectures every few years, I had a house, and my house was open to him. So Mark would stay in the guest room, and I'd drive him around to these different lectures. For me, it was a beautiful thing as a fan to give back and allow this person who had influenced so much of my outlook to have a place to stay and not have to think about that and not have to think about transport. I mean, it was truly a pleasure, and his talks never got old for me. I loved listening to how he put things together and how he reacted with the audience. It was a lovely lesson in how to express yourself to an audience about what could be boring topics and make them interesting and involved and dramatic and go over stuff so that folks would walk away feeling not just educated, but enlightened. Fast forward to the end of the 2000s, and the band Negative Land was coming for a tour in the Northeast. And talking with the band, I offered my home as an alternative to paying for a hotel. They accepted it immediately, and the entire band, a band that I had admired for 20 years, stayed over at my house for a few days. Looking back, it's almost like a dream. I mean, imagine a band that you really care about, whose work you've been following for decades, and here they all are, having breakfast, smoking out on the porch, talking about things, making plans, asking your opinion on things. It was beautiful. I found all of them charming. It was just what you would expect. Perfectionism meeting up with doing the right thing and the band voting on different ideas. And through all of this, I really got to know Don. It turned out Don warms up to people, but it takes a while. And naturally, through a few shows, there wasn't much of us hanging out for him to warm up at all. But over these days, Don warmed up to me and started to talk to me. And I guess it helps to understand, if you've never seen him, what Don is like. Don Joyce, especially by this time, was a lanky, gray-haired, very sour-faced looking man. He was a chain smoker, and he was really given to pronouncements and then sitting back and complaining. He was, in other words, the personification of gruff. I remember playing a few videos for the band, including Don't Download This Song by Weird Al Yankovic, and Don getting very angry and walking away because in the song, Weird Al makes jokes about your downloading songs causes us to not get our limos, and Don was just livid that Weird Al would imply in any way that most musicians weren't actually rich and holding on by the skin of their teeth trying to survive day to day for their art. Another thing I remember is that we were looking for a place to eat near the performance space and halfway between there and my house, and there was a diner-like place called the Cambridge Common over in Harvard Square, and I took the band there, and I remember Don looking around, saying, "This is a good feel. Let's see how the coffee is." And the coffee showed up, and he drank it, and he said, "Yeah, this is the place." And from that point on, whenever we needed coffee or we needed something to eat, Don would say, "Well, we're going back to the Cambridge Common, right?" I just remember being so amazed that in just a short time, he had a habit, a place, a home base that would give him the coffee in the way he wanted it, when he wanted it. After the performances were done and the band packed up and drove away, I became, I guess I would say, a trusted person, a resource the band could have if they needed something done or if they needed to reach out. They knew that I would come through with things if they needed it. When the band had a art gallery showing in New York City, I drove down to see everyone, and that was the last time that I saw all the members of the band. I had a lovely dinner with them, and I had a really good time talking particularly to Richard Lyons, one of the band members who's known as Pastor Dick, who told me both about his health issues and about the large archive of tapes and materials that he had and what we could possibly do to save them. Through all of this, Don continued to run the Over the Edge radio show. Hours upon hours of new, interesting material playing on KPFA through the night. Only once or twice was I at the Internet Archive, and I thought while I was driving around late to listen to the show. I never visited the KPFA studios. I never got to see the show being done live. But once or twice, I turned on the radio, heard the strangeness come over the air, and delighted that this sort of thing was going on. A lifetime of smoking caught up to Don, and he eventually became too sick for his show, and after a few weeks in the hospital, died at the age of 71. This presented a number of situational problems that I'm happy to say I could play a small part in mitigating. Don was the one who was running the record company. And by record company, we're really talking about stacks upon stacks of books and tapes and CDs that you could buy through Sealand Records. These were all in Don's apartment. Also there was a recording studio that Don had built, where many of the band's albums were recorded and which he had continued to use to build new sounds for his radio show. To his credit, Don's landlord had kept the rent artificially low for Don, allowing him the ability to provide this artistic service to the Bay Area for years beyond where it would have been too expensive to be able to rent a place of such size and with so many rooms. But with Don's passing, the landlord made it clear that building was going. The band reached out, I reached out to some volunteers, and we were able to pull out recording materials, master tapes, and all of the products of Sealand Records and transport them over to the Internet Archive's physical archive in Richmond, California, where they are to this day. It was a pretty strange experience for me to walk up those stairs into Don's apartment. This was a place he had been in for decades. It had all of those lovely touches of individuality on stickers and posters and people who had gone through there. And obviously Don had a whimsical sense and also lived a relatively Spartan life in terms of being focused on audio and editing and music. The volunteers were great. We had things moved out of there really quickly. And I thought about Don while I was there, this gruff, distant fellow who had brought so much audio joy to the world, who, it was said, didn't have a lot of interest in interacting with people on a personal sense beyond those he trusted and slowly built up relationships, but who, ironically, portrayed the best and worst of people through recorded instances of them, whether it was commercial jingles or speeches or newscasts. He had created, through Over the Edge, a lens into humanity's own character, while in his own way not being particularly interested in the real humans at all. So what had been done over the years was that Don would do air checks of his shows. He would record them and then edit them down and then put them away. And he had tapes upon tapes upon tapes of shows that he had done. His early 1980s work, there wasn't very much of, but he had created hundreds of tapes of shows, these incredible works that would take him a week to put together, that would go in different kinds of themes and create these dense, involved pieces that would then be mixed with live callers. They were masterpieces, these Over the Edge shows, and it turned out there was an archivist, Tim, who had been transferring all of these tapes to WAVE files for a very, very long time. Where I had said to Mark years before that there was no place to host them, I was happy to be able to take Over the Edge in its entirety and put them up on the Internet Archive, where Don Joyce's masterwork can live on. He was a wonderful guy. I'm so glad I got to meet him. And this superfan misses him very, very much. This is Jason Scott, Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to Adam Green, Mark Pilgrim, James Bekoyanu, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been helping me stay out of debt. One last thing. Mark Hosler did a small tour in the Northeast, and I made it a point of going to pretty much every show that I could get to. And at one point, we had a conversation, and he told me a very wonderful thing. There had been a fan of Don's back throughout the 1980s, and he rightly thought Over the Edge was unique. So, pretty much every single week, he'd been recording the shows onto audio tape. When Don died, this fan wrote in to say that he had all of these tapes and would they like copies, but nobody had gotten back to him. A year and change later, somebody did finally get back to him, but they got the man's nephew. In the interim time, this fan had died, but the nephew, recognizing how important these tapes were to his uncle, had kept them all. Those tapes have now all been digitized, and soon the Over the Edge collection on the Internet Archive. This beautiful, haunting audio museum is going to double in size.